With that, we're going to have our speaker for the evening. His name is Phil from Vitality. He's 17 months. My name is Phil, an alcoholic. I was hoping we were going to go through everybody from Vitality, so it would take a little longer before I had to get up here and let everybody introduce themselves and all that stuff. Thank you for having me. Try not to sound too stoic when I say the stuff that everybody else says. Thanks for having me. Thanks for asking me. I will tell you that there was a guy called me one day a couple months ago, a guy named Bill, who had no idea who he was, and he said, hey, I asked your sponsor to come up here and talk at our meeting, and he said he had already spoken up there and that he knew someone that would want to do it, and so here I am. And you know, I'll be honest with you, I thought, one of the things I thought about is that this is the first time I've been asked to come out of town and speak, and I thought, well, maybe I'm being set up for a hit or something. I didn't know, but you know, maybe they're going to get me up there. And, hey, can you be in Clovis on June 28th at 5:30? I'm like, yeah. I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. I'll start at the beginning. You know, I have a God-given sobriety date of January 8th, 2013, which is 537 days, which is a personal best. It's something that that I've never been able to achieve before. I've been in and out of this program many times. And the fact was that, you know, and when I say that I've been in and out of this program many times, it's a lie. It's not the truth, it's delusion. And because delusion for me is my truth, it just doesn't happen to be real. But I believe that. So I would tell myself, oh, I've been in and out of this program a million times. I know AA doesn't work. I've been there 1,000 times. And I got zero results because I never did any of the work. I never got involved. I never did anything. I'd do a couple quick steps, maybe, you know, I'd get a sponsor and I wouldn't call him or something, or I'd see him at a meeting, or I'd go, oh yeah, that step works, yeah, I'm getting on it, yeah. And pretty soon, you know, I've been taught, I believe that through my experience, that that window of grace, for me, this time around, is very short. Or it could be, I mean, there was times I can tell you that it would last 45 days, it would last 30 days, it would last 60 days sometimes, and I'd be sitting in meetings. Or I'd be in another program, usually, sent there by the court again, and they'd say, hey, go to AA, you got to do this, get your card signed, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd be there, you know, 30 days, whatever, and I'd be like, man, that's great. This is wonderful. I should have done this years ago. Well, I didn't, you know. And then all of a sudden, about 30 days in, I'd start to get that anxiousness and that guilt and that shame and all those things that we talk about would start piling up on me, and I'd skate, and I'd be gone, and that window of grace would close for me. And I'll tell you what, this time around, at 537 days, I'm still riding the pink cloud going this way. Yes. Only because I believe that I got into the steps right away with my sponsor. I got a great sponsor sitting right down here in front. And I'll get to him in a little while. let me go back to the beginning. You know, I was born in Paso Robles, California. Grew up down in Ventura County, Camarillo down there. My parents were providers. My mom, let me back up because my mom's here tonight. And that's one of the... tell you what, you know, she's here. I have about 20 of my friends that came from Vitality with me, and my sponsor's here. Heck, my boss's wife's even here. You know what I mean? So that's my people here to keep me in line, I believe. You know, but that's a beautiful thing, man. I'll tell you what, 18 months ago, there was anybody that wanted anything to do with me. All they said was, get out, don't come around, we don't want to see you, what do you want, what's wrong with you, why are you here, what's wrong with you? That's usually what it was. Today, my mom is... she's over there crying right now. I have a hard time looking at her because I don't want to cry right now. But so I grew up down there in Ventura County. I was a good kid. I played baseball. Baseball was my game. I loved it. I was on an all-star team. We played all-star baseball. I made all-stars every year, like I said. Baseball was my thing. Was a good kid. Went to school. There was no verbal abuse happening. There was no physical abuse in our family. It was a good, structured family. My mom was a waitress. My dad worked at the youth authority. They were providers. I always had the best baseball cleats, the gloves, new clothes every year for school. Everything was great. And so there was really no reason for anything to go south. One of the things that did happen at about 12 or 13 years of age was that my parents split up. And it kind of caught me out of left field. It was a very traumatic thing. You know, I mean, we were there one day, and my mom took me and my sister in the room and said, you know what, hey, I'm going to be moving out. And it was really a gnarly deal. And because what happened is the whole structure of the family changed. And then my dad was at work all the time, and me and my sister were home a lot by ourselves and stuff. And at 12 or 13 years of age, I still went to school and stuff. And I mean, I didn't start drinking and using until much later. But it was a thing. It was something that happened. And And I carried a resentment against my mom for that for many, many years. And until I got into this program and got to really look at what was really going on there, because I thought, how do you leave your kids? You know, how do you walk out on your kids? What's up with that? What did I do wrong? How am I at fault? What happened? You know what I mean? And I through the step work and stuff, and I hope to get to that a little later in my story about how we've been reconciled through this program, because I have a different perspective on that whole situation today. It wasn't about me. And I'll get to that in a minute. But like I said, growing up, everything was good. I can tell you that when I read in the big book, it talks about me a lot here, and one of the spots that it talks about me first is in the doctor's opinion when it talks about drinking for the effect produced by alcohol. And for me, I'll tell you what that looks like for me. When I was 16, I think my best friend was Jeff was 15, and his parents had bought him a car, and he didn't have a driver's license, and I did. And so we would drive that car around, and I'd pick him up for school and stuff, and we'd go up to high school and whatnot. And the very first time that I could tell you that I drank and felt the effect of alcohol, and I'll tell you that my entire life I've always been intimidated by females, and this was no exception. But that night, we had a bottle of Southern Comfort that got passed around, the big one with the handle. And I'll be honest with you, I really don't even know where that came from. I don't know how we got it or what, and we were out at the beach in Ventura, and we had these two girls with us, Angela T and Angela O, and one was his and one was mine, and we started to drink that alcohol, and you know, that bottle went around, and you know what, I was pretty cool with that girl that night. I took her home, and I snuck her into my dad's house that night, and I did what I needed to do with her, and you know what happened that night is I started to live that lie, that you know what, when I drink, I'm cool, I'm good, I can hang out, I'm part of, I can talk to the girls, I'm not intimidated by females. There's no rejection, even if she would have said no, I'd be like, yeah. Oh well, move on to the next, you know what a shrimp is, babe, that type of thing, you know? So I started to live that lie, you know, and another lie that I lived too is that I thought that people liked me better, and I thought I liked myself better too. I felt better. I heard a girl say one time, and you know, I'm not saying that this is how I feel, but this is how she described that feeling of being under the influence. She said that when she drank, she felt prettier, wittier, and tittier. Yeah. And you know what? I
get that.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And so that, you know, that's kind of the same. I relate to that. in a way. Yeah. Anyways, so growing up, you know, like I said, that was the first time that I drank for the effect. And then, you know, I was in high school at the time, and I started to drink a little more regularly. Like I said, my mom was gone, and my dad was usually at work, and there was no parents around my house, and we would party at my house and stuff, and I started smoking some weed then too. And one of the things that the first times that as I started to drink a little more, we would get in that car, me and my friend Jeff, and this guy Kirk that we used to hang out with too. And before school, we would head up to Vaughn's grocery store right before first period there. And we all had like $2 for lunch and lunch money, and we would go to Vaughn's grocery store, and we'd swing to the liquor department, and we'd all grab a half pint of vodka and put it in front of our pants, and we'd walk up to the check, and we'd grab a Mountain Dew or a 7-Up, and we'd go up to the check stand, and we'd tell the lady, we'd give her our money, and she'd say, oh, thank you very much, and we'd say, no, thank you, and we'd walk out the door, and we thought that was so cute and so funny, and then we would get in that car, and we'd go back down to the high school, and we'd sit in the parking lot, and we'd drink that alcohol down, and you know what, I would last probably two periods in school, and then it would start to get, like, feel the effect of the wearing off stage, and then I'd be like, oh, God, you know, that thing, and then we'd take off. I'd be out. I started to ditch school all the time. I was hardly in school, and I would go home, and we'd probably smoke some weed at my dad's house, and then we would, then I'd sleep for a couple hours, and I'd get up, and I'd go to football practice, because I was, like, leading the double life type thing. I was getting loaded in the morning, and then going to be in the jock in the afternoon, and hanging out, and I always stayed in sports, because I'm a huge sports fan and stuff, and I was always active with that, and slowly, even that started to fade. I remember that in my junior year, when baseball season came around, I just didn't play because, you know what, I was doing other things, and that was like my passion, man. It was gone, and that was one of the things that alcohol and drugs took away from me early. Fast forwarding a little, I was a junior in high school, and it was going to be summertime, 1985, Memorial Day was coming up, and me and my friend Jeff had been planning this boating trip that we were going to go with his older brother and his older brother's friends and some other people, and we were going to be no parents were going, and there was going to be some other chicks there. My friend's brother was bringing his girlfriend, and her little sister was coming, and we were going to drink some beer, we're going to smoke some weed, we're going to have a great time, we're going skiing for the weekend, it's going to be wonderful, right? And about 2 days before the trip, we got hot off campus, I guess, I can't even remember, but I think we were smoking weed in the bushes or something, and we got suspended from school, so we got X out of that trip, so and it was like that big event, you know, I mean, this was like the, man, no parents, I can't wait, we're going to do this, and we got caught off campus, like I said, and we got taken out of that trip, And there were some signs, and so the day of the trip came, and my best friend Jeff's mom was like dead set saying, no, you're not going, you're not going to, forget it. And we were asking, please, we'll never smoke weed again, please, I'll go to school every day, I swear I'll never, you know, this and that. And we were begging her, and she was like, no. And then something happened with the trip, with the lights on the trailer, and the trip got delayed a little. And so we were asking, and the next thing, something happened with one of the tires on the trailer, and then they waited a little longer, they couldn't leave. And finally, she caved on us, and she said, you know what, just go. So, and we went. We had a great time. We were up there 4 days, and everything was great. We were drinking beer, and I met a girl named Jake up there. And once again, alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I took her in my tent. And we had a good time. And alcohol allowed me to do the things that I needed to do with her, for what I wanted to do with her. You know what I mean? That was part of it. It was another lie that I told myself, that I needed that alcohol to do what I needed to do. And it worked. And so that boating trip, it was the last day of the trip. It was a Monday afternoon, Memorial Day, 1985, May 27th. And we were cooked from the trip. You know how the last day of the camping trip is, and everybody's baked, and you just want to go home and take a shower, and nobody wants to do it. And so we're packing up the stuff, and we had to take the boat from the campground around to the launch ramp to retrieve it. And so my best friend's brother, Jeff's brother, said, Gary says, who wants to go? You know, we're going to go retrieve the boat. And I said, I want to go on and ski one more time. So he said, cool, and we got in the boat. It was a flat bottom boat with a bench seat across, and there's only room for three in there. So there was me, my friend's brother, Gary, his girlfriend, Margo, and their niece, Melinda, which was about 6 years old at the time, and me. And then, like I said, there's only room for three in the boat, so I said, I'll just ride up here on the bow and the front, and I'll lay up here, and if we get out there, I'll jump in and ski. It's no big deal, right? So we started to go, and if you've ever ridden in a flat bottom boat, it's pretty rough when you get in the rough stuff, and I'm laying up there in the front, and it's bouncing me. I mean, my feet are flying up in there, and I said, hey, slow down. And I looked back, and the next thing I split off the front of the boat. The boat ran me over. The propeller caught me in the arm, almost chopped my arm off, almost killed me. There was blood and guts and carnage and broken bones, and it was a very traumatic experience. I talked to my friend's brother, Gary, or Jeff's brother, Gary, about it, and he said that when they circled back to get me, they couldn't find me. I was underwater, face down, in shock. I don't remember any of this, but he said it was one of the hardest things about it was getting me back in the boat because the water was now over his head and he couldn't push me up in the boat and I was dead weight. And Marva's freaking out and the 6-year-old's horrified, traumatized, and it was a really traumatic deal. They take me in and put me in the car and all that, get me back to the shore, put me in the car to the hospital. And I had some surgeries and stuff, and they life-flighted me up to San Francisco, and there was a time when they were talking like, oh, we can save his life, but we can't save his arm, we'll probably have to cut his arm off, but he'll survive, that type of thing. I mean, that's how serious it really was. That boating accident was a very life-changing thing for me because what happened is that when I recovered from that boating accident, I was out of high school. I had taken the GED test, and all my friends that were my age went back to high school after summer was over. And so now I'm out of high school, and now I'm hanging out with my sister's older boyfriend, who's like 19, 20, 21, and I'm 17. And they're doing, they're selling weed, and they're drinking beer every day, and they're doing all the stuff that seemed like everybody wanted to do, you know. And so for me, that event changed my life. And later in my story, I'm going to get back to that because you're probably sitting there thinking, well, what does that have to do with recovery? But, you know, and I thought that too for a long time. Other than the fact that it changed my life and I went that direction, you know, I'd like to think that in my head that before that boating accident, I was a pretty good kid and I was pretty good at baseball. And so my ego likes to think that by today somehow I maybe could be in the Hall of Fame or something. Because I was pretty good, yeah. But that didn't happen. And so like I said, my life changed and I started to smoke a lot of pot and I started to drink beer every day and I started to hang out with the older crowd and they were doing cocaine and they got introduced to cocaine and the selling of that and whatnot and all that stuff, and like I said, it changed my life in a drastic way. And I would go into a 28-year cycle of spree and remorse, like the book talks about, that cycle of spree and remorse, where I would go on these benders and everything would be great, and then I would get caught, and now I'm remorseful. And I'd go to jail, and I'd wake up in jail, or I'd make that phone call home to my dad, and I'd say, I'm locked up again, can you please send me some money? And he would, and you know, there's, I'm going to read something out of the book because I'm going to go a certain direction with this, and this is probably the time to do that. Actually, in the back of the book, in Freedom from Bondage, it says, I'm going to tell you a little story about how I can relate to this too. Right here it says, rationalization is giving a socially acceptable reason for socially unacceptable behavior. And socially unacceptable behavior is a form of insanity. And the way that looks to a guy like me is like this. I was a criminal. I was a thief. I was a manipulator. I was a liar. I did what I had to do to get what I needed. At anyone else's expense, I had no, I had a couple children by this time. Not that I didn't love them or anything, but I was having a good time. I was partying. I was doing what I thought was everybody else was doing. You know what I mean? And stuff. And so they were suffering too. And I had a boy and a girl. And me and her, his mom split up. Anyway, back to that rationalization thing. The way that looks for me is like this. I remember being in a Walmart parking lot one day. What this says to me right here is it says that if I can come up with a reason that convinces you and me that it's okay to do what I'm doing, I'm going to keep doing it. Right? And so I'm we're at Walmart one day, walking through the parking lot. I just left the store. I come out, and we found that there's a wallet laying on the ground. It's a woman's wallet, right? And I said, man, look at this. Great. I pick it up, and I open it, and there's ATM cards and check cards, and I thought, and I'm looking at the picture, and I'm thinking, this idiot, boy, she's look at PIN number written right there off her ATM. What a, she deserves this. Right? That was my attitude. You know what I mean? How could you be so stupid? You know what I mean? So anyways, being a good crook that I am, I go, hey, we gotta go to the ATM, right? We gotta get right to the ATM before they report this stolen, because I gotta get what I can out of this. I'm gonna ride this as hard as I can. That's how it was. So we go to the ATM, and I know, you know, I'm a pretty good criminal, right? So I say, okay, I'm going to go up there. And, you know, I've always been the guy that had to prove himself to everybody, right? I got to win everybody's, what do I have to do to get you to like me? That was my attitude. What do I have to do to earn God's grace? What do I have to do to, you know what I mean, that kind of stuff. So I was fearless. I would do stuff that no one else wanted to do. And this is no exception right here. So we go up to the ATM, and I get out my hooded sweatshirt, and I put it on, and I pull it up over my head, and I pull the strings tight. There's nothing showing up in my eyes. And I get up there, and I take the card, and I put it in there. And I push the button, $200 comes out. I go, oh, great. All right, got $200. I get the little thing to set the thing out of the card. I look at our account, it says negative $12. I go, ah, that's no good no more. Put that away. Take my $200, we go, we party, we have a great time, right? I'm sitting in jail one day on a totally unrelated charge, right? I'm arrested, I'm in jail. They call me, they go, hey, you got a visit. I go, sweet, a visit, all right, cool. I never get visits. I knew that. I knew she'd come back. She's finally seeing my way, right? That's what I thought. I get out there, it's a detective, right? From the fraud bureau, right? And he says, what do you know about this ATM withdrawal, right? And I know the code, you never tell on yourself, right? I go, hey, that ain't me. I'm getting all loud and getting indignant. He's got to prove it ain't me. Right? I'm in this guy's face. He says, hey, take a look at this. And he hands me a piece of paper. And it's a picture of me at the ATM with my hooded sweatshirt on. I'm going, ah, it's still the night. I'm like, hey, nothing, what are you going to do? You go take a look, and I look a little closer, and in the background, there's my car with the license plate right behind me. And I'm like, but you see, the way I see that is this. The way I see that is I didn't steal that wallet, I found that wallet. Right? I was rationalizing, just like I just said. I'm coming up with a reason to convince me I knew that it's okay. And I'm going to keep doing it. I ran with that. I lived my whole life that way. As long as I was okay with it, and you were okay with it, and there was no reason to stop. I'm going to live that way today. You know, go back to those, to the kids that I have. I have a boy and a girl. I actually have three kids, and two of them live in Oklahoma right now, and I have an estranged relationship with both of them. Well, one of them I haven't talked to in over 20 years is my son, and my daughter I've just recently reunited with kind of over text messages and the phone and stuff like that, and I have another 18-19-year-old son who lives in Simi Valley, which I'm still in contact with semi-regularly. He's more in my life than both of them. Before getting into the program, you know, I want to tell you a story too about over here on page 24. I'd like to refer to the book because this is where I found my solution. Because right here it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The way that looks like it is like this to me. I was on parole. My youngest son was living with me and my dad over in Paso Robles. He was probably 13 at the time, right there. Yeah, I think he was in seventh grade. And I was doing pretty good. I had a good job framing houses. I had my own truck. I was, like I said, I was on parole, but I was working and stuff, and I wasn't staying clean and sober, but I wasn't in trouble, which was good. I was doing okay. They weren't looking for me. That was about the, like a high point. I mean, they weren't chasing me, but I was doing pretty good. And so I'm at work one day, my parole officer called me. He said, "Hey, I need you to see me in my office on Friday. I need you to come in here and test for me. I need you to be clean and sober. Come here and give me a test." And this was like on Monday, and I thought, "Oh, yeah, no problem. I can do that. Great. Just take." So Monday turns into Tuesday, and you know what? I'm still doing what I do, and I'm like, and you know, I'm starting to worry about it. I'm like, "Oh, man, God, what am I going to do? I need to help me, God, please." You know, I still got 4 days of school, you know? So Tuesday turns into Wednesday, and now I know Wednesday I got to stop because I got to have 3 days to get out of my system, and I got to get in there by 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. So now I'm really praying, you know, I'm just going to do this one more time, and I'll get through the day, and I'll be fine, right? And I'm just going to stop. And I don't know about you guys, but I know that on my own power, I cannot stop once I start, which is what makes me an alcoholic and an addict, just like the book talks about. So now Wednesday becomes Thursday, and now I'm really getting, I'm like, "God, please help me. What am I going to do? You know, I got to come up with some sort of excuse. What can I do? How can I do this? How can I get out of this? Please, you know, there's got to be an answer. Please help me, you know." And my attitude was really like, "Well, you know, I'll deal with that when it gets there. You know, that's really it. So I'm still 24 hours away. I'll be fine, right? You know what I mean? It's not here yet. I'll just cross that bridge when I get to it." So Thursday turns into Friday, and now I'm really freaking out. I'm like, get up Friday morning. I'm like, "Oh, my God, I got to assume today. What am I going to do? But I can't go to work without this." And I'm like, "Oh, man." So I take my son to school that day. I drop him off at school, and I was working in San Luis Obispo at the time. And Paso Robles is like 35 miles from there, and the parole office is in San Luis Obispo. And now it becomes noontime, and I'm in the restroom, the porta potty out there, and I'm doing my thing in there, and I'm thinking to myself, "Now, what am I going to do? What am I going to do?" And I know I got to be there in like 3 hours, right? I'm like, "Man, I got to come up with some reason. Maybe I can convince help." So you know, 3 o'clock comes, and I call my son on the phone, and I said, "You know what, man? I got to go see Mr. Faye today, and there's a good chance that I'm probably not coming home tonight. So you're going to have to go ahead and walk home. I won't be able to take you up." And I'm begging him on the phone. I'm like, "Man, I'm sorry. I'll never do it again. I'm so sorry. I swear I'll never do this again. I promise. I need it this time. If I can just get out of this, please, God, help me one more time." And so now, you know, so now it's like 3, 4 o'clock almost, and I'm like, and I go, "You know what? I'm going to call him. I'm going to call him. I'm going to see what he says. I'm going to just man up right here, right? That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to call him. I'm going to admit to it, and I'm going to see what he says." So I call him on the phone. I say, "Hey, Mr. Faye, you know what? You know, I'll tell you what, you know, and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is where I go when I drink and use. I'll just be honest with you. I was circling the parole office, driving around in my truck, hitting the meth pipe, going, "What am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? Oh, my God. I got to go in there and see this guy." So I go in there, so I call him, and I say, "You know, hey, I'm dirty, man. I don't know. I'm scared. I don't know what to do. I'm dirty." He goes, "You know what? You need to come in and talk to me." And I go, "Well, are you going to arrest me?" He goes, "I don't know. He goes, we need to talk about it, but if you don't show up, I'm coming to get you." I'm like, "Oh, man." So now I'm driving around again. Going, "Oh, man. Now what am I going to do?" So I circle the thing, and I get my courage up. It's about 4:45, and I say, "You know what? I'm going in, man." And I go in there. And I go inside, and I talk to him. I say, "Hey, man, you know?" And he goes, "Yeah, I appreciate your honesty, man. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and cut you a break on this one. You know what I mean? I want you to sign this form admitting to being dirty. And if I'm here, you know what I mean, we're going to keep you on parole since you're doing good, you got a job and stuff, and you're honest. I appreciate that. He goes, but I want to see you back here next week, and you better be clean and sober, right?" I said, "Nah, cool." I get out of there. I get back in my truck. I get on the freeway, and I'm going, "Woo, man, I almost got caught. Woo, I was almost overreacting to that. Woo, that was close. Woo." Couldn't remember it, just like I just read. I couldn't remember what I was going through 15 minutes before that. Unable to recall. You know what, I got home and, you know, through some step work, you know, I hate to share too much about what it was like, but I think you guys get the gist of what it was like for me. I mean, that story alone, I want to get into some of the things. I've heard a lot of people, I do go to a meeting a lot down in Visalia about, it's at the Creative Center, the ICE House, they call it, and it's a speaker meeting, and I hear a lot of people talk and tell their stories and stuff, and they get up there. And it seems that whenever someone tells their story, they get to a point in their story and they say, and then something happened. And this is exactly true for me too. And I'll tell you what that something was that happened for me. See if I find it. I was once again back in recovery court. This is back in January of 2013. I had been arrested again. I've been running on a warrant, felony warrant that I had. And I, you know what, I used to drive by the, I would go by the Alano Club there in Visalia, and I would drive by and I'd see everybody standing out front and I'd be thinking, those sorry bastards, look at those guys. You know what? Look at those guys. And you know what? Knowing all along, deep in my soul and my heart, that that's exactly where I belong. You know, I just wanted to be part of. That's all I really wanted. But my pride and said, you know what? Those guys are losers, man. Look at them. Smoking cigarettes out there laughing. What a bunch of idiots. And I would drive by the county jail, and I would see that building. Well, I've got a felony warrant. And I'm like, I'm going to be back in there one day. I don't know when. It could be today. It could be tomorrow. I mean, that's no way to live, I'll tell you. That sucks. And I lived that life for many, many years. So I ended up getting arrested, and once again, they put me back in another program. I've been in lots of programs, lots of county jails, been in prison several times, in and out. And so this time around, I come to the Alano Club down there in Westlake, and you know what? And I'll tell you, I didn't go there that day to get sober, and that's why when I say that I have a God-given sobriety date, I didn't pick my sobriety date that time. I did not select it like I had in the past. Oh, I'm going to get sober next week. Or I'm going to get sober next month. Or you know what? When I get arrested, then I'll do it. It just happened this time. I was there. I was sitting in the Alano Club. And you know what? There was a, and I'll be honest with you, and I've talked to my sponsors here tonight. He's right here in the front. He's a great man. I'll tell you what. Like I said, I've been to prison a few times, so I used to think that I had this tough guy image, and I was just all about hard, you know what I mean? And oh, yeah, I was this guy and that. And I was a criminal and a gangster and an outlaw. And I'll tell you, the police straightened me out when they told me I was a public nuisance. So anyway, I come in with all this, you know, that pride, this contempt. And I'll tell you what, 18 months ago, you couldn't have convinced me that I'd be sitting in a room full of people that I didn't have any idea, I don't even know, and that I could stand in front of you and tell you that I'd love another man that I didn't know at that time. There's no way you could have convinced me of that 18 months ago. I would have thought that there was some sort of lifestyle change coming for me or something. Or maybe I'd be in a cell with Bubba telling him I loved him, you know what I mean? Because he was forcing me to or something like that. But to sit here and say that I love this guy and not be ashamed is something that's a really great miracle in my life. Back to the Alano Club. And I'll tell you what, I I've been in and out many times. I got this contempt priority investigation thing going real hard. I got... like I said, AA people are losers. I knew AA didn't work. I've been there lots of times. It's never worked for me in the past. I've convinced myself that there's no possible way that I can ever get out from where I am. But the book talks about once we have placed, what it says that once this sort of thinking is fully established in an alcoholic or a person with alcoholic tendencies, then they've probably placed themselves beyond human aid. My take on that was that I was so far behind the grade at 45, 44 years of age, that there was no way that I could ever catch up. And so I was like, well, what's the use anyhow? You know what I mean? I was convinced. I got here, I was sleeping on the floor of my mom's house when I got here 18 months ago, again. Not really supposed to even be there. Had put her at risk of getting kicked out where she lives. She's not supposed to have anybody living there. I didn't. And I was up all night out there in the yard building stuff and digging sprinklers and doing all kinds of whatnot at 10:30 at night in a senior village community, you know what I mean? So here I am at the Alano Club on January 8th, right around January 8th, generates my sobriety. So it was probably like, I did a couple days in jail after that, so it was probably like the 13th or 14th, I'd say. And I walk into the Alano Club, and I'll be honest with you, you got the unsolicited AA guy that's always there, you know, the guy with the big book under his arm, and the guy that wants to shake everybody's hand, and he's the guy I used to make fun of, yeah. Because he had the solution, and I didn't want nothing to do with him, you know what I mean? Because I was afraid of him. And I didn't realize that at the time. I just liked to make fun of him. Oh, that guy's a jackass. Look at him. He came out and hope I'm never like that. And you know what? Today I've turned into that guy. Because I stand with Jordan, I shake hands. And I'll be honest with you guys. You know, because I've been encouraged to be honest with you. I'll be very, very honest. When we got here earlier, and we pulled up in the parking lot, nobody came up and shook our hand. And I was a little bit offended by that. Not really offended, but my take is that, you know what, it's my job to welcome the people that are, what if we were new, or what if, I, you know what I mean? That's the way I see it. Please don't take that as a put down or anything like that. All I'm saying is that, you know what, I like to do it differently. I like to put myself out there and shake people's hand and get to know their name when they come in the door and welcome them and say, hey, man, we're glad you're here. What's your name? Because people did that to me. They learned my name and I felt part of. I So please don't take that wrong. I didn't mean it as a derogatory comment or anything like that. It's just kind of as I wish that would have happened. Yeah. They're like, don't worry, you're not coming back anyway. We'll never ask you that. Okay, so anyway, so I'm sitting through a lot of stuff. Like I said, and I got my contempt priority investigation thing going. I'm judging this guy right here sitting in the front row, and a couple of people got up and shared it. And you know, and a couple of people got up and talked, and they started to talk, and I was like, man, I can't believe I'm sitting in AA. God, I'm watching the clock. It's not here. I'm here for the court card thing again. I can't believe I'm doing it. All that stuff. And a guy named Bill Hassman got up there, and he started to talk and tell a story, and he started to talk about how back in 1999, I believe it was, he was planning this boating trip, and he was going to go out and have some fun with his friends, and they were going to go to Lake Havasu, and they were going to go get drunk, and they were going to drive this boat, and they were going to water ski, and they were going to have a great time, and this and that. And I thought, sitting in the chair, I'm like, oh my God. And he talked about how he all these signs along the way that were telling him, don't go, this and that. He was seeing billboards that were saying, don't boat and drive, or don't drink and boat, or we'll take you to jail. And he was like, that's a good idea, but clearly they're not talking to me. I actually didn't put that. And that was the kind of things that happened with that boating trip I went on, too. It's like the lights of the trailer were bad, and the plug in the tire, and the you're not going, that type of stuff. All those little signs were saying, don't go. And I didn't hear any of them. You know, and he talks about the same way. And I'm sitting in the chair at the auto club, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is, and he went on to talk about how he got this great idea after a whole day of boating and stuff, and they'd been drinking all day, and his friend pulled him around skiing, and then he got in the boat, and he was driving, and he pulled his friend around, and his friend fell, and he had a great idea. He was going to come driving up and turn the boat real quick at the last minute and spray water on his buddy and laugh, and it would be great. And he ran him over. And you know what? And nearly killed him. Just like, and I'm sitting in the front row of the auto club, and I'm shaking. I'm like, oh, my God. This is the guy I've been looking for right here my entire life. All my whole AA career, this is the guy. You know, I started up, and I talked to him after. I said, you know, and so not only do I believe that I have a God-given sobriety day, but I believe that God also picked my sponsor for me. He carried the message that I needed to hear. I didn't know I was going to hear the message that day. I wasn't looking to hear no message. I wasn't looking to hear anything. I was looking to get out. I just went out of jail. I just went out of rehab. I just went out of whatever. I just went out of trouble. I wasn't trying to get sober. That's why it's so nice for me this time, I believe, is that it all came unbeknownst to me, kind of. You know what I mean? It just kind of landed on me. It was just kind of the way it unfolded and stuff. And I developed a relationship with him, and I got into the step work right away. He's a big step guy. He's totally into the step work. And you know what? Like I said, I would always come into, every time that I came into AA in the past, I would do like the first three steps or maybe a couple steps, you know, I'll do a little prayer or whatever, make a little writing, you know, and say a little prayer, get on our knees, big deal. And I'd get to the fourth step and I would stop. I was done. That was it. I wasn't putting no effort in. And I would sit, like I said, I would sit in meetings maybe 60, 90 days, whatever. That pink cloud would be great. And I'd be like, man, I should have done this years ago, man. It's so great. This is wonderful. And then all that stuff, all that pain and emotions and anxiety and all that stuff would just pile up on me. And I'd be like, man, I gotta get out of here. I'd be gone. I'd go. You know what? I'll tell you, it hasn't happened this time. Because I've dealt with all that pain and emotion and shame and all that guilt and all that stuff. You know, there's a few things. I mean, my mom, I've got to make amends with my mom. You know, I got to make amends with my mom. And she, you know, for the first time in her life, she got to say, hey, I'm proud of you, instead of what's wrong with you. You know what? We tried tears of joy instead of tears of sorrow for the first time in a long time. I got to make amends with my sister, my oldest sister, who I hadn't talked to in over 20 years. This is how selfish and self-centered I am. My sister, okay? I grew up with a real type, man, when I was young. I was like 7. She was 4 or 5 years older. I think 7 years older, something like that. Anyway, and so she was like getting into high school and stuff, and I was just a little kid. She'd take me out of school, and she'd go, come on, you're not going to school today. We're going to the mountains. And we'd go hiking, and we'd go rock hopping and stuff like that, hang out and do all kinds of stuff. So we were close, you know what I mean? And then she did her thing, got married, and moved off, right, and had a couple kids, and I visited her once up north. And then I started to do the things that I was doing and getting in trouble and stuff. And she said, you know what? If you're going to do that, cool. Don't come around me. Don't bring it to me. I don't want nothing to do with it. So Christmas time would come around or something, right, and she would... And we'd call her and say, hey, man, are you going to bring the kids down? We're going to get together. You know, Dad's getting kind of old. We'd like to get everyone together, you know? And she would say, oh, yeah, I'll be there. And then, like, the day before Christmas, she would call and say, hey, we're not coming, sorry. And I thought, what a flake, man. How selfish is she? What's wrong with her? Right? This is kind of how the fifth step worked for me. I hate to be, I'm kind of jumping around. And so, but I definitely want to finish this thought. The fifth step for me, when I got into this program, the fifth step, I thought, I read that thing on the wall and said, you know, we admitted we were wrong, or admitted to God there are a thousand others, you would be the exact nature of our wrongs. And I thought, well, you know, I was a thief and I knew it was wrong, so now I got to go tell those people that I stole from that it was wrong and I knew it and I did it anyway. Sorry. Now I did my fifth step. That's cool. Right? And then through as I've grown in this program, I've come to find out that my fifth step is more about how wrong I really was about everything. My perception of everything was so far off base. Like I said, I would go back to that thing with my sister, and I thought, what a flake. How dare you be so selfish and not come to Christmas? Dad's dying. They've got cancer. He's going to die in like 6 months. This could be his last Christmas. Get down there. And she wouldn't come. And I got to make amends with her, and I got to sit down and talk with her, and I said, you know what, I read my little paper to her, and I said, you know, this is, I'm sorry for this, this, and this. Cut you out. I'm sorry. I hope this doesn't sound selfish, but I said, I'm sorry for depriving you of an opportunity to know me. You know what I mean? I hate to say that because it kind of sounds conceited when I say it, but it's the truth. You know what I mean? And vice versa. And then when I finished saying my little thing and talking to her and stuff, and she laid into me, man. And I said, is there anything you want to say? And she really tore into me. She, you son of a... She went off and she was bawling and crying and I was crying and she said, you know what, at the end, you know, and I've heard people say that the ninth step is more about the other person than it is about me. And you know what, and I never experienced that until I sat down with her. And she got to share with me, she said, you know what? I feel like I can finally take off my armor that I've been wearing for 20 years. Because I was afraid of you. I didn't come to Christmas because we were afraid of you. I didn't want to expose my children to you. Oh my God. I was so far, I had no clue. I had no idea. That's how I've changed in this program. My perspective on everything has changed through working the steps. I'm able to look at that and say, you know what? Man, I was an idiot. I don't know. My life is completely different. I want to, there's some things I want to, I got about 15 more minutes, but I want to make sure that I touch on a few things. Some of the things that happened, so anyway, I developed this relationship with Bill, and we started on the steps, and I got involved in the steps right away. One of the things that I want to talk about, too, is that I've heard it said in this program that the sponsor's job, I heard a guy say that the sponsor's job is really to entertain the newcomer until God takes over. And I think, God damn. Right? And thank goodness, because that's exactly what happened for me. I mean, Bill's a great sponsor, don't get me wrong, but you can ask him, and I believe that, you know, the credit, we give credit where credit's due. He got me on a path that led me to a relationship with a higher power, which has changed my life and solved my problem. My problem was me, and I never saw that. And I've finally been able to accept personal responsibility for what an idiot I've been my entire life. You know what I mean? And I'm not ashamed to admit that. You know what? I mean, my pride and my ego, you know, oh, I don't want to tell these guys. I really don't want these guys to know that I feel that way or to think of me that way, you know what I mean? But it's the truth. You know, I'm not ashamed to admit today of that. You know, I go anywhere I go. I mean, even at work, I go to work and we had this little huddle before work when they hired me and they were like, well, we know you're in AA and whatever, it's just going to stay in this room. And I was like, cool. You know, and so cool. And it's good. That's great. You know, and so I go out there and I start working with these fellas, and I'm working with these like 19-year-old kids, and I got one guy that's like 24, he's had 3 DUIs, and he's been hooked on every pill under the sun, and he's done this, and shot heroin, all kinds of stuff, and I said, dude, if you need some help, man, let me know. I mean, I'm not ashamed to admit, I have been given a way to help people that no one else can, man, you know what I mean? I don't know. I don't even know what my thought is on that. But you know what? I have no shame in saying that if you need some help, come to me. Man, I'll put it out there. It's kind of a resource for someone. Let it be known. Because my life has changed. I want to shout from the rooftops that AA does work today. I mean, that's really what I want to talk about. Anyway, so I come in here and I was struggling kind of with that God thing. Back to that God thing. I was kind of struggling with the God thing. And I came up with this conception of God was this... almighty guy up there sitting on the throne waiting to throw me back in prison. I was in a construction accident. I lost a finger in a construction accident, and people would tell me stuff like, well, you know why you lost that finger, right? God took that from you, you thief. That's why. I would believe that. I'd be like, oh, yeah. Like that stuff over there in those countries where they cut your hand off. You know what I mean? I'd be like, oh, man. Could make sense, yeah. That type of attitude towards God. God's not going to help me. God's not going to come out and help me personally. You know what I mean? That type of thing. And so I want to share a few things today that in my life that have happened through a different conception of God. I have now come to find that, you know, Bill, when I did my second step, he said it was real simple. I'm going to steal another thing that I heard a guy say. He said there's no written instruction in the big book on how to do the first two steps. But the only two steps that don't have any instructions, so you really can't do it wrong. Right? I believe that. So the way me and Bill did it, this is the way it worked for me, is he said, you know what, I want you to come up with, write me a list of characteristics of what kind of higher power you got. You know, I always thought it was like, what do I have to do to earn God's grace? And he said, well, what does God have to do to work for you? Mm-hmm. Right? He let me out of the box, you know what I mean? Gave me the keys to the kingdom. He said, you know what does God have to do to work for you? And I came up with this conception of God's loving, he's all-knowing, he's all-powerful, he wants me to do good, he wants me to be sober, he wants me to help others, he wants me to prosper. You know what I mean? He wants me to be with my children. He wants me to be with my mom. He wants me to do this. He wants me to carry the message. I believe today that I've gone through all this heartache and pain in 28 years, 20 and a half years, so that I could stand here today and say, you know what, if I can, you can. That's my message today. I carry the message of hope, hopefully. They tried to scare me into recovery many times. The message of fear doesn't keep me here. The message that has kept away from me is the message of hope. You know what, if I can come up here. Now, they said, if you do this, you're going back to prison. Send me. Not a big deal, I can do it. Prison was never an alternative for me. I'd go to prison with my dad, would send me packages. He'd send me money. He enabled me. He was loving me the only way I was able. He was providing for me. He didn't know. He was just trying to make me comfortable. He was killing me. He didn't even know it. Like I said, I would go back to this God thing. I was struggling with God for a while, and like I said, I got let out of that box. And it was only through the step work, like I said, and developing this relationship with God that I got to... Some great things have happened. Today, I'm not full-time employed, but I'm part-time employed. I get like 30, 35 hours a week at a place. It's just kind of a menial job, but it came through the program. It came through one of the people in the program, like that. I was praying to God, and I said, you know what, man? I want to, please give me a job. I don't want to work in a restaurant. I don't want to work inside. I want to do something outside. And so my brain says that, you know, I'm a construction guy. I want to work construction. I want to frame houses. I want to do this. This is what I want to do. And I got a guy called me one day and said, hey man, I might have something on the freeway, $29 an hour, come on down. And then I get there and they're like, oh, you got to join the laborers union, it's $850, and there's 150 people on the out of work list. And oh my gosh, that didn't work out. I thought, oh, I guess it was supposed to be. And then I had another thing where I was supposed to go work at Harris Ranch, meat company thing over there. That fell through. And so I'm praying to God, I'm like, yeah, just give me something outside, right? I get a phone call one day, a guy says, hey, I got something over here at the golf course. I'm going to come over to the hospitality position at the golf course, man. I think you're perfect for it. And I got a job at the golf course, man. I'm outside. I'm schmoozing with people. I'm the face of the golf course. You know what I mean? I'm out in the parking lot. They got me in this host position, man. I'm welcoming them in. Like I said, 18 months ago, it wasn't even safe to have me at the golf course. I would go there at night. They were gone. Stuff like that. That's one of the things. You know what I mean? And it's just like, when I allow, here's one of the most profound things that I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard a guy say, he said, God does not need my permission to work in my life, but he does need my cooperation. And I'm like, man. And it's just like that. When I let God do stuff and let the job come to me, I'm not out knocking down doors. I wasn't laying around not looking for a job, but it just kind of came to me. Anyways, back to that, to the kids in Oklahoma, I'll try to do this quickly. Today my life is completely different. Like I said, I'm employed. I have I just finished the DUI class that I had to do. I paid my way all the way through there. I got my driver's license back today. I haven't had in like 7 years because I didn't think it was necessary. I thought, you know, watch, I don't need a little card to tell me drive. I can drive. I know how to drive. That's going to stop me. I don't need a card. And so anyway, they get cleaned over and stuff, and I was doing the thing, and they said, well, we need to see your driver's license. I'm like, oh, man, I don't have one. So I go back down to DMV anyway, and I sign up, and they say, oh, you got DUI in 2009 that nobody told me about. And I thought, I do remember it now. So I did the DUI class, and I paid my way through, $30 a week. I mean, every Monday for 15 weeks, I had to give them $30, and I had to give them $100 to sign up. And you know what? And here's another thing about AA that I love so much, is that when I tell that story, you know, oh, I'm 44 years old and I got a $9 an hour job and I got my driver's license back and I'm clean and sober 18 months and I come into AA and I tell those stories and you guys go, yeah, hell yeah, you guys relate. You're like, yeah, because you know how tough it is for a guy like me to get there, right? I take that story to my high school reunion, right? And they go, dude, you're a freaking loser. Yeah. That's what I love about AA. I'm here. I'm part of. You know what I mean? You guys lift me up with that stuff. Anyway, So my daughter, I have a daughter and a son that live in Oklahoma. And when I got in this program, there was like I said, I hadn't talked to her in many, many years. And out of my own fear of my pride and my insecurity and my ego and my whatever you want to call it, my fear of guilt and shame, and I was afraid to chase that relationship with her because my daughter, because like I said, I was afraid. I was ashamed of myself. I had nothing to offer. I can't. I told her many times. This time, I'm really going to do it. I'm working in a good direction. I got 6 months sober. Everything's great. I got a job. And I go back out. And I wouldn't talk to her for like 2 years. I go back to prison or whatever, and I wouldn't talk to her for like 2 years. And so then she would, I would get back in contact. She'd call me. She still called me all the time. I mean, she kept trying and kept trying and kept trying. And I was like, I'd get a phone call and be like, oh, man, I really don't want to talk to her. I'm afraid. I don't know what to say. My own fear was causing harm that I was totally unaware of. I thought it was me that was being hurt. You know what I mean? And so fast forward to this time around the program. Like I said, about 5 months ago, I have two granddaughters in Oklahoma also. Actually, two that I'm in contact with and two that I'm not. So the two that I am in contact with, like I said, I had my own fear, my own pride stop me from doing that. And one of the things that my sponsor told me when I first came into the program was, he said, if you want what I got, then you're going to do what I do. And I've learned that selfish and self-centeredness, that's really the core of my problems, right? And what he does is he shakes hands at meetings. He goes early. He sets up meetings. He does commitments. He goes to all kinds of meetings. I mean, it was, when we first started on the thing, he's like, he'd call me, he'd be like, I'll pick you up in 20 minutes. He doesn't even have to go. I'm on my way. I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to go, you know. And he's like, will you come and get me? You know what I mean? And he'd say, hey, we're going to the ICE house now. I'll be there in 20 minutes. Click. We'd be driving in the car or something. It was like, I felt like a little kid sometimes. It was kind of embarrassing. We'd be driving that day. He'd be like, you think we can get some ice cream tonight? He'd be like, we'll see. Like I said, he told me, you know, if you want what I got, then you're going to do what I do. And so he goes to the hospital a lot. He'd call me and say, hey, one of our guys is in the hospital. I'm going to see him, man. I'll pick you up in 20 minutes. And I'm not. All right. And I go. And I've gone several times with him, right? There was a guy in the program called Bill one day and said, hey, I'm out of town. My uncle has just found him across town laying in the gutter. He's dying from alcoholism. He's yellow jaundiced, and he's in the hospital, intensive care, whatever. He's yellow jaundiced up. He's got liver failure, pancreatitis. He's going to die, man. Will you please go see him? So Bill calls me and says, hey, come on, we're going to the hospital. Picks me up and go there. We get there, and sure enough, we walk in, and this guy's in the bed, man. And I had never seen anything that advanced. I mean, it was shocking to me to see this guy. His legs were up around his thigh area. It was about as big around as my wrist right here. And his feet were out from under the covers. They were blackened from no shoes. I mean, I'm talking like wore off. He was just deliriously messed up. And he kept saying, all he kept saying was, I just need one cigarette. Let's just leave me one cigarette. I just need a cigarette. And it was like, man, I was like, dude. He goes, where are you guys from anyway? Well, I'm from AA. We came to talk to you. We're friends with your nephew. Oh, my nephew? Oh, man. So, you know, it was just kind of a thing, and I thought, well, you know, we're here, we're doing the thing, we're doing the gig, you know, is there anything we can do for you? And he's like, oh, no. He said, and then we were getting ready to leave, he said, will you come back tomorrow? And so Bill said, sure, we'll be back tomorrow for sure. Right? And so selfish and self-centered is the core of my problems, right? Talks about it in the book. So the next day passes, and I go to, I'm in my DUI class that day, and I'm a huge hockey fan. You know what I mean? I love the LA Kings, and it was hockey season, and the game was coming out at 7, my DUI class ended at 7, and I'm getting in there, getting in the truck, and I'm ready to drive back to my house to watch it, and I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to go home and watch this game. And my phone texts, and text message from Bill, and says, you ready to go to the hospital? Mm-hmm. Ah. Something that God, that speaks through people, came into my head and said, if you want what I got, you'll do what I do. And one of the things that he has is he has relationships restored in his life today, with his family. He doesn't have any kids, but his family loves him again. His dad, he talks about his dad and stuff like that. And I want that. So I said, okay, I'll meet you at the hospital. I meet you at the hospital. We get there. We start to walk up to the room. And as we approach the room, this guy's room, there's a lady standing out front. Okay? I have that daughter that I talked about in Oklahoma. She has two daughters, my granddaughters, that I've never met. I've never talked to them on the phone at this point. And my relationship with her is, like I said, strained because I'm afraid to talk to her. I'm afraid, I'm embarrassed. So we walk up to that hospital bed room, and the lady standing out front we strike up a conversation with her, and she, it turns out that she's the daughter of the guy laying in the bed. And she has two daughters that have never met their grandfather. And she wants to establish a relationship with them and let them meet him one time before he passes away. And I had a moment of clarity. You can call it what you want. I'll call it a spiritual experience. And what that did for me is I suddenly realized, like it talks about the promises that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And it allowed me to go home and to make that phone call to my daughter. And I'll tell you what, I'm not saying that that relationship with my daughter is perfect or anything like that. It's still long distance, and it's not rosy or anything like that. But she's calling me, you know. And today I know the ages of my granddaughters. I have them as my wallpaper on my phone. I talked to my daughter for like 40 minutes last night on the phone. She texted me. I got home from the meeting. And she texted me, and the text message said, "Hey, Dad, are you busy?" What's that? Five simple words. You know what I mean? But you know what? You know how good that made me feel? Man, you know what? And she talked about, you know what? It's not about the past. It's about the future. We need to move forward. She's way more mature than I am. I'm like, where did you come from? Like, do I know you? Yeah. She's got two kids. She's a dental assistant. She's married. She's got her own place. She's doing the deal. You know what I mean? And she wants me back in her life, man. And you know what? When I step out of myself and allow that to happen by doing something that I didn't even know was going to happen, I just went to that hospital room to be there for that guy, and look what I got. And I allowed God to let that happen. And without this guy, it wouldn't happen. You know what I mean? I don't know. I think I've run out of time, but you know, I just want to say thanks for having me, and I hope I said something that might help somebody tonight. Thanks.
Give Phil another hand. Yeah.